existing barriers, because what we're going to see is that Jesus is going to have a discussion with the people that are around him, and there's going to be some hardships presented. They're going to have some difficulty with some of the things that Jesus says. And I think that it is typically our response that if there is a barrier put in the way, that you want to help somebody remove that barrier. We want to provide a way of ease for them to accomplish or to go where they're going. And Jesus, as he's reaching out with the gospel message, we would think that probably doubly true when you think about reaching out with the gospel, that if there's a barrier in somebody's way, what we'd like to do is make the removal of that barrier from their life as easy as possible. And Jesus is going to take a totally different approach. Jesus is going to say some things that even once the barrier is presented, once the confusion is there, that he's going to do some things that rather than appear to be opening a door, seem to be closing a door, rather than removal of a barrier, it seems to be a very direct and specific attempt of Jesus to erect barriers before these people. And we want to look at that for just a minute and see if we can't figure out why that is. And if you'll recall what has happened previous to this, Jesus has fed a large number of people, 5,000 people, and Jesus has provided from very little food that he had, just those few loaves of bread and fish, and provided food for all of these people in a very miraculous way. And so much so that they picked up more food after everybody was completely full than they started with. So you can imagine being in the crowd and having seen that. I mean, imagine what it would be like to be able to see a miracle performed where you had no food, the disciples didn't know what to do, and Jesus multiplies these fish and these loaves to the point that they pick up those 12 baskets full of food. You would have to be highly impressed. And they were. They were very impressed with the miracle that Jesus had performed. And so they followed him for that. He had fed them, and the people followed him, but mainly followed him for that reason. Because as he went to the other side of the lake, verse 26, they had found him on the other side. It says in verse 25, he had gotten in a boat and gone. They had eventually gotten over to where he was, and they found him and said, "Rabbi," in verse 25, "when did you come here?" "We wanted to come with you," is basically what they are saying. And Jesus answered them and said, "Most assuredly, I say to you, you seek me, not because you saw signs, but because you ate of the loaves and were filled. Do not labor for the food which perishes, but for the food which endures to everlasting life, which the Son of Man will give you, because God the Father has set his seal on him." And so Jesus is going to start this procedure in, I think, a very gentle fashion. Jesus has said, "You know what, you're following me, and I understand that, but I'm telling you, you're following me because I gave you food." And he said, "But there's something more important than food." But he feeds them, and he provides healing for them in chapter 6, and then you get to this section, and they're going to start to have a conversation, because Jesus is going to take them from where he had been physically in the feeding and the healing of them, and he's going to point them toward their spiritual needs. Jesus is going to say, "I understand why you came." That's only logical, really, that a person who has been fed would seek food. And so they followed him, and he says, "That's what you're here for." But he says, "I'm telling you that you're laboring for the wrong thing." He says, "I want you to take your focus, and I want you to shift your focus a different direction. You're thinking about the physical side of life, and I want you to be focused on the spiritual side of life." And so he's trying to point them toward their spiritual needs. And so in doing so, he's going to say, "You can have bread that is way greater than the bread that you just had." I mean, they'd enjoyed a good meal, and they were full. But Jesus says, "I can give you bread that not only will fill you that way, I can give you bread that will take you and provide for you everlasting life." Can you imagine if you had a really good dinner last night, and then today you were talking to somebody and they said, "You think that food was good? I can give you food that will cause you to never die." But don't you think there would be some intrigue there? You'd want to know about that. And so they did. And they said to him, "What shall we do that we may work the works of God?" Jesus answered and said, "This is the work of God, that you believe in him whom he sent." Therefore they said to him, "What sign will you perform, and what shall we see in order to believe you? What work will you do? Our fathers ate manna in the desert, and as is written, he gave them bread from heaven to eat." So Jesus has got them exactly where he wants them. And he says, "Most assuredly, I say to you, Moses did not give the bread from heaven, but my Father gives you the true bread from heaven. The bread of God is he who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world." So, I mean, he's just got them hanging right there. He said, "I understand. Moses gave bread in the sense that he was the agent of God in doing that. But God is the one who gives life." He says, "And God has given bread from heaven for life." And look what they say. They said to him, "Lord, give us this bread always." He promises bread of life. They said, "Please, please give us this bread. We want to share in the bread that provides life." But they misunderstand him, don't they? Because Jesus is going to take them a little bit different direction than this. Jesus is going to take them towards spiritual understanding, even though their focus is totally on the physical nature of what he has said. And Jesus said to them, "I am the bread of life. He who comes to me shall never hunger. He who believes in me shall never thirst. But I said to you that you have seen me, and yet you do not believe. All that the Father gives me will come to me, and the one who comes to me I will by no means cast out. For I have come down from heaven not to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me. This is the will of my Father who sent me, that all he has given me I should lose nothing, but should raise it up at the last day. And this is the will of him who sent me, that everyone who sees the Son of Man and believes in him may have everlasting life, and I will raise him up in the last day." Now they're going to, Jesus says, here's what you need to understand. Jesus says, I am the bread. That's a different concept for them. Moses was the provider, God the provider, but Moses the agent for the manna. They understood that. This is the bread. Jesus is not pointing down saying, "This is the bread." Jesus is saying, "This is the bread." That's going to cause confusion, because immediately before this, they said, give us the bread. We want the bread. We want to share in the bread. We want to have a part of this everlasting life. What is it that we can do in order to enjoy the benefits that you're talking about?" And then you get into verse 41. The Jews then complained about him because he said, "I am the bread which came down out of heaven." They're offended at this. They're offended. They're bothered greatly by the things that Jesus said. They complained about him. Have you heard him? Have you listened to what this man has said? They grumbled. They were murmuring under their breath. He says he's the bread. Now you have to think, if you're a Jew, that's a concept that goes against the grain of anything that would have been good and pure and holy if you're thinking on physical terms. They had very strict dietary laws, the Jews did, as to what was acceptable and what was not acceptable. And Jesus is going to take them in physical thinking. Now, they're thinking wrong. They misunderstand him. But he's going to take them and offend them because he's going to be talking about spiritual terms that make it sound like, from a physical standpoint, that it's cannibalism. And to the Jews, that would have been as horrific a thought as you could possibly have addressed with them, especially regarding the idea of eating. So you think, you know what? Maybe move on to something else, Jesus. You know what? You're talking to them about what is true, and man, all of a sudden, they rear their heads. They're not happy any longer. They were happy here. They're not happy now. And so you think, you know what? Back off a little. I mean, doesn't that seem like the logical thing to do? Somebody raises a strong objection and we say, you know what, well, let's back off a little bit. But Jesus doesn't back off. He adds to the offense. Verse 42, they're saying, "Is this not Jesus, the son of Joseph, whose father and mother we know? How is it then that he says, 'I have come down from heaven'?" And Jesus answered therefore and said, "Do not murmur among yourselves. No one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him, and I will raise him up at the last day. It is written in the prophets, and they shall all be taught by God. Therefore, everyone who has heard and learned from the Father comes to me. Not that anyone has seen the Father except he who is from God. He has seen the Father. Most assuredly, I say to you, he who believes in me has everlasting life. I am the bread of life. He's going to say it again. You're offended at that? I'm telling you, I am. I don't want you to misunderstand what I said. There was no misunderstanding what his claim was. They were offended because he said he was the bread of life. Jesus says, I'm telling you, I am the bread of life. He says, your fathers ate manna in the wilderness and are dead. This is the bread which comes down from heaven that one may eat of it and not die. You can just picture him pointing at himself. Can't you? I mean, he says, I am the bread of life. He says, your fathers ate the bread that Moses provided and every single one of them died. Physical food, physical death. But he's saying, this is the bread that provides eternal life. How can he give us his flesh to eat? It says in verse 52. He says, I'm the living bread in verse 51, which he says came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he's taking them deeper into this analogy, but he's saying, I'm the bread that's come down from heaven. If you eat of this bread, eat of me, he says, then you can have that life. He will live forever, and the bread that I shall give is my flesh, which I shall give for the life of the world. Well, it's no wonder they were mad. How is it possible that we eat of his flesh? What is it that this man is even claiming that we're supposed to be doing? It just seems like one of those times where you think, you know what, Jesus, if you'd just soft-pedal it a little bit, if you'd help explain it a little bit better, if you'd back off the offensive terms, then how much easier would it be for these Jews? But it almost seems as if Jesus is saying, I'm going to put this barrier in front of you, then we're going to have to decide what to do with the barrier. I'm going to erect this barrier right here. It is me. I am the bread of life, and you have to eat of my flesh in order to have eternal life. He uses even more provocative words when he's talking about eating my flesh. He says, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man, in verse 53, he says, and drink his blood, you have no life in you. I'm saying, just think about the conversation. If you're a Jew, Jesus said, I'm telling you, unless you eat of the flesh of the Son of Man and drink of the blood of the Son of Man, you have no life in you. And then it gets worse. Verse 54, he's going to change words in the Greek. He's been talking about eating of him and eating of the manna, and the word that he uses in the Greek is the word that is the typical word for eat, and it just carries the idea of eating anything, taking a bite of something. In verse 54, he changes to a different word in the Greek when he says, whoever eats my flesh, he's changed to the more graphic version of absolutely just consuming something. Not that I'm picking up and taking a little bite of something. I'm not pinching off a little piece. He's saying that you're gonna take a bite and take a chunk of something. Have you ever you done that? You've eaten two different ways. There are times that, depending on what it is, not sure if you like it or not. You ever done that where you just take the fork and just, you know what, I'm going to take a little tiny piece. But then somebody brings out your favorite cake or your favorite meal, and there might be a tendency to take that big bite with all that frosting and everything on there. And I want to get the full sensation exploding. I mean, that's great when you're talking about cake. What about when you're a Jew and the Son of Man is saying, I'm telling you, you need to just absolutely take a bite. That's the word he uses. He's saying, you need to absolutely consume me in that sense. He says, whoever eats, whoever lives by eating my flesh, whoever makes a meal of me, not just a little bite, but makes a meal of me and drinks my blood has eternal life, and I'll raise him up in the last day. How graphic is that to the Jews? Is it any wonder any wonder that they're confused. They don't know what to say. They don't really know what to do. He goes on and says in verse 55, "For my flesh is food indeed, and my blood is drink indeed." True food. Real food, my flesh. Real drink, my blood. "He who eats my flesh and drinks my blood abides in me, and I in him. As the living Father sent me, and I live because of the Father, so he who feeds on me will live because of me. This is the bread which came down from heaven. Not as your fathers ate manna and are dead. He who eats this bread will live forever." How hard is that? I mean, these are hard, hard sayings. I mean, we read all of those things in retrospect and in hindsight and understanding the situation. So sometimes we miss the impact that the things that Jesus says. But we see the impact in other things. When you take the gospel message to the world, some people respond well to some things. Some things they have a great difficulty with if what you're saying is when Jesus said the same kind of things in other places, didn't he? "If you love mother or father more than me," how hard of a saying is that? I mean, that's a hard, hard saying. When he's saying you have to take up your cross daily and follow me, unless a man denies himself, he cannot. Those are tough things. Jesus sometimes erects barriers in front of us, and I think that there's a reason that he does that. Why would he erect a barrier? I mean, how well did it work here? He went on to talk about that there were some of them that did not believe down in verse 61. He's saying when he understood that they were complaining about this, "Does this offend you?" That's that word scandalizo in the Greek, to cause to stumble. Going to cause you to fall? I said something very tough. Is that going to cause you to fall? Well, what's the answer to that? Verse 66 says, "From that time, many of his disciples went back and walked with him no more." Why? Because they said, these things are tough. These things are hard. What is it that Jesus is trying to do? And here's the point, at least for me, and I hope this is the point that we can take from this. If we understand the method of the conversation, not just the truth that he taught, but the method, is because Jesus is not interested in superficial faith. Jesus is not interested in getting us to have a list of things that we believe in truths that we hold to be true. I'm not saying that's not important, but he's trying to take us way beyond that. Jesus doesn't want our faith to be shallow. He wants to take us out of the shallows into the depth of faith, like some of his characters in Bible times had. He wants to help us to understand that he's not interested in numbers. He never was interested in numbers. You can make the gospel more appealing to larger groups of people, possibly. But he's saying that's not his appeal. He's looking for us to be something deeper than just what is at the surface. And sometimes it isn't when we're looking at others. Sometimes we need to examine ourselves to understand, are we at the depth of faith that God is trying to get into us? Or do we have a certain amount of religion? What kind of faith do we have? How deep is that faith? He wants true disciples, people who have lined up behind him and want to enjoy the true, true relationship with Jesus Christ. And that's what he's looking for. And he wants us to understand that. And I think this is why. I think what Jesus is trying to do is he wants us to scale that barrier rather than go around them or have them torn down. Why? I think Jesus says, here's what I'm trying to get people to do. To get the ladder of faith and lean it up against those barriers and to climb that ladder. Because as you climb the ladder of faith and you scale over the barrier, you have new heights. You have new vision. And I think that's where he's trying to get us. He's saying it doesn't help you if what I do is we just remove all the barriers and you can keep walking at the pace. He says, I need you to put in the effort to scale that ladder of faith and to get on top of that ladder and to go over that barrier, to overcome and to have the depth of faith that allows us to face the next barrier. That's what God is looking for. But that's a hard fight. And we need to understand that's a hard fight. Following Christ is truly challenging, and He never, ever once wanted to make it seem any different than that. He wanted all of us to understand to follow Christ requires everything we've got. What did it require of Him? What did it require of Jesus to go to the garden as He did and to be arrested as He was and to live the life that He lived and to serve mankind the way He did? What did it take for that? What did it take for Him to go through that trial that He did and to hang on that cross that He did? What did that take? How much effort would you say it required of Jesus to get from where He started life to where He finished life when He could look at His Father and say, "It is finished"? Not "life is over." What You gave me to do, I did. I can't imagine that there'd be anything more I'd rather say as I'm ready to pass from this life than to be able to say what Jesus did. The work You gave me, God, I did. I'll never be able to say it the way He did because I've already failed in some of those areas. But He's saying, how much do I need to redouble that effort? So that I understand what it means. What it means to be a true disciple of Jesus Christ and to do that. Think of some of the others. What kind of faith did it take? What kind of, when God said, "I know you're 100, I know you're 99, I know all of that, but I'm telling you, I'm going to give you a son, and it's going to be the son of promise. I'm going to make a great nation out of you." What does it take to have faith? What does it take to have faith? Abraham and Sarah. Nothing within the realm of reason would help them to think that was going to happen. Nothing within the realm of reason. But I think that's what God is looking for. God is saying it isn't within the realm of reason. Faith is that which grabs reason by the throat and strangles it and says, "You can do because I said you can do." And that's what He tries to get us to understand. Think about the children of Israel coming out of Egypt. "I've given you a promised land," and they've been told that story. "Been giving you a promised land." And so all of a sudden, they're slaves in Egypt, and things are not going very well. And about the time you think things couldn't get much worse, they're growing stronger as a people and larger as a people in Egypt. And so the taskmasters double their work to keep them worn out so they can't rise up in rebellion, make their work harder. And then as they get ready to leave, they have to face the armies of Pharaoh. And then can you imagine what they felt like as they're standing by the Red Sea and the armies of Pharaoh are charging down on them? And then they've got no water in the wilderness and no food in the wilderness. What does it take? What does it take to get beyond the reason and have the kind of faith when God says, "I'm taking you to a promised land"? Well, it took more than a lot of them had, didn't it? Because even when they got on the border of the land that God had promised them, what happened? They went in and they said, "Oh my goodness, look at the size of these giants. We could never, ever win this battle. These people will pummel us if we go in and fight them." That's reason, not faith. God is saying they needed faith. They battled that the same way that we battle that. Think about Job. Everything about reason would have caused Job to give up. If not on the first go-around, how about on the second go-around? Well, now all of a sudden, besides everything else that he has lost, he's now lost his health as well. And his own wife is not even on his side. Curse God and die. And Job says, "Though God slay me, I will trust Him." You want to talk about faith? There's no barrier that I can't overcome if I have the kind of faith that God says that I should have? And that's the question that Jesus asks. He tells a parable of a judge, an unjust judge, to make a point. But when he gets to the end, he says, nevertheless, when he comes, will he find faith? What kind of faith? The kind of faith that has been lifted up out of the shallows into the depth of believing that God can do all that God has said that he can do. Not believing it in our minds, but believing it by our actions and trusting that he will do what he says that he will do. I want to read to you a statement made by a young man. Nick Vujicic is his name. Not even sure where he's from, but in 1982 he was born with tetraamelia syndrome. It's a rare genetic disorder where you are born with no arms, no legs at all, just a torso, and that's the way he was born. Two small but not usable feet attached to his torso, but no legs at all. He struggled when he was young, emotionally trying to figure out all of that. It was sometime later in his life that he submitted his life to Christ, and here's the way he describes his life from that point forward. He says, I have a ridiculously good life. Now just think about that for a minute. He says, people come up to me and they're amazed when I say that I have a ridiculously good life. And they want to know, how is it that I could possibly say that I have a ridiculously good life? He said, they come up and they'll try to explain things to me. You know, eventually it will all be better and you won't be in that body any longer. And he says, and I understand that. Or they say, you know what, God has all the answers even though we don't have all the answers. And he said, I live my life by a couple of thoughts. One is, I believe that not only does God have all the answers, but he said, I'd rather live my life this way, that God is the answer today, tomorrow, and forever. He says, I live by that adage. And he said, so I choose to live my life that way. And when people see me in my life and they talk about my strength or my victory over my disabilities, he tells them, victory came, and this is what he said. I tell them that my victory came in surrender. It comes every day when I acknowledge that I can't do this on my own, so I say to God, I give it to you. Once I yielded, the Lord took my pain and turned it into something good. He gave my life meaning when no one and nothing else could provide it. And if God can take someone like me, someone without arms and legs, and use me as his hands and feet, he can use anybody. It is not about ability. The only thing God needs from you is a willing heart. I think that's a great point, and I think that's what Jesus was trying to get across. He's saying it isn't the barriers. Barriers are there because they will help us to scale to new heights, whatever they are. Sometimes they're just barriers in our life, but there are barriers that are presented in everybody's life. And Jesus said, every barrier, whatever the cause of it, physically, spiritually, whatever, it will allow us to scale the ladder of faith and reach a new height. I hope that's our goal. If you're not a Christian, we pray that you would respond to God. Don't have any idea what is or is not happening in your life, but what God does promise is he can take your life and he can make it into greatness for him, exceedingly abundantly above what we ask or what we think. He can do that with our life. It's a submission to him. I give myself totally to him. I choose to live by the flesh and the blood of Jesus Christ, not by the flesh and the blood of Mark. That's what Paul said. I've been crucified with Christ, but I still live. And that's because Jesus lives through me, Paul said. We hope we can help you do that today. If you're not a Christian, don't know what to do, let us talk to you. We'd love to sit down and open his word and show you what God says. For those of us that are Christians,